Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest on this episode is Justin Shubo, president of the National Civic Art Society.
There, I think this was also in the report on the Eisenhower monument proposal. This discussion of certain values that are associated with modernism, namely rationalism, kind of hyper rationality, asceticism, kind of self denial, power, efficiency, and then there are also certain values associated with postmodernism, that kind of idea of ephemerality and transience. You know, nothing will really last very long, so it's just going to keep kind of changing and building and being destroyed over and over again. And you contrast those with the classical values. I guess my question would be, in our time and place, it does seem like it's sort of an uphill battle for classical values and classicism, in that the status quo seems to lead to, you know, maybe kind of kitschy postmodernism on a popular level and kind of elitism on the modernist level. My question is, do you see classicism as kind of fighting this uphill battle, or are there reasons to think that they can be hopeful for classical values?
Oh, it's,
I mean, of course,
it's an uphill battle to put it mildly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, right now there's essentially only one or two schools in America that teach classical architecture.
Notre Dame, right?
Notre Dame is the main one. And I guess another one is University of Miami.
Okay.
To some extent. So the schools are dominated by modernism, I mean, which right. I mean to include its progeny.
Right.
And it's not as if, and there's really no diversity of views.
Yeah.
And students aren't taught how to draw. They don't really learn the history of architecture prior to modernism. It's as if the past has been completely erased and we're starting from the year zero. So architecture is in a very bad state. However, there is, at least among some people who are open, a crisis of confidence.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Gehry himself said that 98% of what's built today is SHIT.
Yeah.
And you'll find other architects saying things like this.
Right.
Now, they have no real solution because, you know, they're unwilling to look to the past. But I think there could be a real crisis of confidence in that the whole system could possibly come tumbling down. You know, something I take inspiration from is the fall of the Soviet Union, where no one predicted that it was going to collapse, and then suddenly it did all at once, because it turned out that no one actually who lived there actually believed in it.
Right.
And maybe something like that could happen in architecture.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there have been revivals in the past. I mean, the Renaissance was a revival,
right.
And there were revivals in the ancient world. And, you know, we're, in my view, in an architectural dark age right now.
Yeah.
And might take a long time, but ultimately, I don't think people are going to put up with, you know, this ugly and in many ways, even disposable architecture.
Right.
When you look at these steel and glass buildings, they do not have long life expectancies. I mean, if you look at a glass building, an architect friend of mine says, you're looking at a pile of caulk.
Yeah.
Because all those glass windows are attached by caulk and it all has to be replaced over time. A masonry building can last hundreds upon hundreds of years. I mean, there are Roman buildings, ancient Roman buildings still in use today in Rome. And so there's a lot of emphasis on sustainability and environmentalism. Well, the traditional architecture very well suits that.
Yeah.
So that's another reason for hopefully there being a return. Furthermore, there are increasingly empirical studies of the effects on architecture on people, so-called cognitive architecture. I mean, they can put sensors on people's heads so that you can do eye tracking and see how people look at buildings, what kind of hospital rooms cause people to get better faster and so on.
Yeah.
And what we're finding is that traditional architecture is just superior in this regard. And, you know, unfortunately, Modernist architecture is such a cult that maybe no amount of argument is going to persuade people.
Right.
And in fact, when you even get mild-mannered critiques of modernism, the establishment will just, you know, come out with guns blaring. An example of this is the book Morality in Architecture, which was published, I think, in 1977 by David Watkin. You know, he was just a British scholar critiquing the intellectual roots of modernism.
Yeah.
And there were just withering personal attacks against him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't want to fight back. And I think a lot of people don't want to be on the receiving end of that.
Right.
Now, you know, I'm not a professor of architecture. I'm not an architect. I'm more willing, I think, to speak about this, to say what I think, because ultimately I don't need to be invited to those cocktail parties.
Right. Yeah. Another kind of aspect of that question might be, I believe that you've written about this as well, that if there's this basic sense of historical relativism, that or kind of deep, maybe it's a paradox or a something, but if people fundamentally have a sense of relativism, i.e. this period in culture has that style and this period in culture has that style, and, you know, every time and place has its own different style, and modernism is one style and classicism is another style, who are we to say that any one of these is any better or worse than any other? Postmodernism is the style for today. Classicism was the style for back then. I mean, do you try to argue that there's something deeper? Like, some is it? Would you say that it's rooted in human nature, for example, or how, you know, how would you respond to say that someone who says it's all purely relative to time and place?
Well, I would strongly oppose the idea that it's relative. Yeah. And I think that in many instances, there is widespread agreement about what, or about which, you know, buildings are great buildings.
Yeah.
So I don't think anyone's arguing that the Taj Mahal is ugly, or that the Chrysler building was a failure, or that the Cathedral of Notre Dame was a mistake.
Yeah.
But then for other things, you will get a lot more debate.
Yeah.
Or you'll get widespread public condemnation, and it's only the architectural elite who will defend the buildings. I mean, the classic case being that of brutalism.
Right.
And the interesting question is, to what extent is there even disagreement? So when the Boston City Hall was built, a brutalist building, the architect Philip Johnson, who was a leading modernist, said, "I love it, it's so ugly." And in other words, he's not claiming that it's beautiful.
Right.
He would maybe agree with 99% of the people who see the building,
right,
but that his value system is different.
Yeah.
Likewise, Frank Gehry has said that life is chaotic, dangerous, and surprising. Buildings should reflect that.
Yeah.
So he might agree that a building is chaotic and will say that's good, while other people will say that's bad. So it's not relativist in the interpretation of the building itself.
Yeah.
In that case, but the value system that people bring to it.
Yeah.
I do think that there is human nature when it comes to the appreciation of the environment.
Yeah.
I mean, even at the most basic level, uneven floors are going to make people slip or feel disoriented. If you have a mass hanging over your head by what looks like a thread, you're going to feel threatened.
Yeah.
There's a book called The Art Instinct that goes into some of the evidence for human nature and art. You know, people like left-right symmetry.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things that are universal.
Yeah.
And not to say that there, of course, aren't cultural influences.
Yeah.
You know, outside of the realm of architecture, just as an example of human nature, is you'll find in music similar scales being used around the world. There's certain just mathematical properties of music that people find pleasing.
Yeah.
Now, in the 20th century, there were composers who tried to, you know, do something different, and those attempts have been largely a failure. I mean, concert halls don't play serialism anymore. Yeah. And I think one reason that what you might call modernism is music in music has been a bigger failure than other forms of modernism is because no one wants to sit in a concert hall and be trapped there for 20 or 30 minutes listening to music that they don't like. If you don't like a painting, you walk by and it's yeah. not going to ruin your day. So yeah. I do think there is human nature.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of widespread agreement about what makes for good buildings. It's only when you come to the 20th century that you start getting widespread disagreement.
Yeah.
And there is something, there is you know, evidence that architectural education warps the students' minds.
Yeah.
Studies have found that architects not only interpret buildings very differently than ordinary people do, but they're unable to even predict how ordinary people will interpret the building or experience it.
Yeah.
So I don't think they went into architecture school with a different fundamental view of the world of space and facades, but rather the architecture school has done something to them
yeah.
to make them come out on the other side with ultimately, you know, different aesthetic sense, different values. I don't think it's, you know, controversial to claim that with the rise of modernism, beauty as a criterion was eliminated.
Yeah.
So again, it's not the idea that, oh, you find this beautiful, I don't, but rather beauty is not important. Other things are more important, whether the architecture supposedly embodies the spirit of the times, or is it sublime and in the Burkean sense, does it instill fear?
Right.
The BBC filmmaker Jonathan Meads has a really interesting movie about brutalism in which he defends, but he says, yes, it's sinister and it's terrifying, and that's why I love it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has a right to that, but to have that point of view. But the point is, these are public buildings. Yeah. And like, not just in the public, some of them are actual civic buildings.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you know, I just put it to, or, you know, to the people, should we be building sinister, terrifying buildings?
That reminds me, there's this line from actually one of our faculty here at UT Dallas, whom you might know, Frederick Turner, who said we have a human nature, and that nature is cultural, and that culture is classical, making a similar argument to what you were just stating about music and so forth. But my other follow-up was, I noted that in the list of buildings, you mentioned the Chrysler Building as a success, and I thought, well, okay, there's like, this is a modern commercial skyscraper, but one that has some of these virtues, it is possible in the midst of Manhattan, or it was at least, to do something that way. And I'm curious if you could say what is it about a building like that distinguishes it from maybe some.
Well, I mean, the Chrysler Building is an example of Art Deco,
yeah,
which I think is essentially the last of the classical styles.
Yeah.
And although it was a brief time period, it's, you know, very popular to this day. And, you know, the Art Deco incorporates, you know, the forms of modern technology, of cars and airplanes and electricity.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, like suggesting that, oh, we're living in, you know, ancient Rome without all that stuff. So
yeah.
It is reflecting its time to some extent, if you think, you know, that's important.
Yeah.
And, but it, you know, and it uses some modern materials, aluminum, but it's ultimately, you know, classical in its composition. I mean,
yeah.
Even the basic idea that a building should have a top, middle, and bottom.
Right.
as controversial as that might sound.
Yeah.
I mean, it you see that in buildings like the Chrysler Building.
Yeah.
It's not a box that just has a flat roof.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not floors stacked on top of floors. And I would say it's also, you know, it's a thrilling building. It's a romantic building. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, Gotham.
Yeah, yeah.
And it shows how, you know, classical architecture is completely compatible with the need for large buildings and the needs of cities in the modern era.
That reminds the sense of the relationship to the column. I guess Louis Sullivan's also, those some of those very first tall buildings had that same sense of proportion. But let me also ask if there are, in terms of at the present time, if there are certain architects whom you might single out as being especially accomplished in this era, or architects or specific buildings from recent years that you would point to as very successful examples of these kinds of
Well, there is contemporary classicism today.
Yeah.
I mean, the flame is alive.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that people know that the tradition exists, that the patrons of architecture just don't have to settle for modernist design as if there are no alternatives. Yeah. One architect who comes to mind is David Schwartz. Another one is Robert A.M. Stern's office, which recently did an entire Gothic college at Yale.
Yeah.
Even though such things are supposed to be prohibited, but right. I think it's been a success, and it's the sort of place that students are going to want to live in.
Yeah.
Another architect I admire is Alan Greenberg.
Yeah.
A more unusual example is that of the firm Roman and Williams. Now they're not strictly classicists. They do all sorts of styles, but they have done work that's neo-deco. They're not afraid to look to the past, and not in a postmodern ironic way, but to make a genuinely pleasing building. And I think that firm is very successful at what it does.
Yeah. I wanted to ask just one or two questions about your work in philosophy, and I understand that you've written on Michael Oakeshott, I thought I pronounced his name, who was a British political philosopher, I'd actually only heard that name because I think he's frequently cited in Andrew Sullivan's political writings. I guess Sullivan's a fan too, but I was interested. Maybe I could just ask if that side of your philosophical work, Oakeshott, or his ideas about knowledge and rationalism and so on and so forth, is there a connection between that and your work in architecture, or is it sort of, would someone like that, his ideas about, I guess, knowledge or however you put it, does that have something to tell us about public space and building and so forth?
So sure. I should note that Michael Oakeshott is not just a political philosopher.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
I mean, he's often called that because his most well-known work is political philosophy.
Right.
But he, like all great philosophers, wrote about virtually every subject.
Right.
And he has profound things to say about the nature of education, about history, about the nature of epistemology. So he's an all-around philosopher who's ultimately offering a philosophy of life.
Yeah.
Unlike so much contemporary English language philosophy, he is giving a real philosophy of life, ultimately the way I see it, he's trying to show how one can be reconciled to modernity.
Uh-huh.
He's a conservative in a certain way, but not an angry conservative.
Right.
sort of with the view of this too shall pass, go tend your garden.
Right.
But I strongly admire him. I think maybe he was the greatest English language philosopher of the 20th century. And he does write beautifully about the nature of knowledge, and a critique of what he calls rationalism with a capital R. Rationalism is this idea that all knowledge is explicit, that everything can be written down, as in a cookbook. When he thinks, or he argues, that so much important knowledge is tacit knowledge. You can't articulate it. It's only something you can learn via practice, by apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So he distinguishes between learning to cook from a cookbook versus, being an apprentice to a chef.
Right.
And no chef can ultimately explain everything that they do.
Right.
And that's a prosaic example, but for him, he thinks that this applies to society generally.
Yeah.
So that, political systems can never be boiled down to, a single algorithm about the rules that society needs to operate. Yeah. That there's always a tradition going on that's unwritten, but that is passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And I think we can see this in architecture, since architecture schools have eliminated the teachings of the past, the great wisdom and knowledge that's accumulated over time. You get buildings that, that don't show any prior knowledge of shadows or light. Yeah. I don't think architects today are largely taught to even think about shadows. when that's something that traditionally architects studied in great detail, or learning how to draw, how to see with your eye. Yeah. So much contemporary architecture is allowing the tools to dictate the design. So since they're using computers, you get computer-generated architecture.
Yeah.
And you know, someone from Oakeshott's perspective would say, well, you know, don't be surprised that architecture is in such a bad state since you have completely eliminated the tradition.
Right. I think the one of the phrases you used are referred to for different kinds of knowledge. Is Michael Polanyi someone who's also in that vein of kind of talking about tacit knowledge?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Oakeshott, I don't think, uses the term tacit knowledge, right. But Polanyi certainly does. Yeah. I don't think they influenced each other, but yes, he definitely has this idea of all of so much knowledge being inarticulable.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, historically for things like architecture, you didn't just go to architecture school, you were an apprentice.
Yeah.
And even to today, coming out of architecture school, you don't know much. You still have to apprentice for a long time. And if you look at the history of philosophy, history of architecture, so many of the most prominent architects really only come to prominence like in middle age.
Yeah.
I mean, Frank Gehry was unknown until, I think, yeah, until his 40s. It's a very hard profession and can take a long time, yeah, to get good at.
There's another kind of question. I was reading what you'd written on Oakeshott. His approach you describe, I think, as again, it's anti-foundational, non-metaphysical, skeptical, and this idea that, like David Hume or Michel Montaigne, is a skeptic reconciled to the world, that he has a kind of skeptical idealism based on the idea of a self-enacting individual. And reading that, I say, okay, well, he sounds very much like a liberal in many ways, which he is, I guess, and he's and perhaps in some ways a relativist, although I'm not sure about that. But yet he's I understand that he's sometimes regarded as a conservative, and so maybe my question is how this kind of sorts out his relationship to, say, liberalism on the one hand and conservatism on the other hand, or he's a liberal conservative maybe.
I mean, well, you know, he, I mean, okay, liberal conservative, these mean different things.
Yeah.
I mean, he very much supports, you know, the British liberal tradition,
yeah,
in the British sense of the term.
Yeah.
You know, going back to Hobbes and Locke and the importance of the individual and,
yeah,
the common law and the parliamentary system. So he's a big proponent of that.
Yeah.
Now, he's a conservative insofar as, you know, he thinks that tradition, as flawed as it might be, is, you know, a good guide to practice.
Yeah.
I think he says tradition is blind, but it's blind as a bat.
Yeah.
And so much of political decision making is very difficult.
Yeah.
And the best hope we have. So the one of his famous metaphors is that of a ship at sea. And that we have no destination. We are just basically trying to keep afloat, and that good political decision making is to keep us on a straight course and not the capsize. And so there's no great end of politics. He's not trying to achieve some kind of, you know, social justice. Yeah. Not that he's, you know, against justice, but that there is no, you know, he doesn't think that the state has a purpose other than to allow, well, essentially, I mean, he says different things in different books, but essentially to allow individuals to live their lives as they so choose. Okay. I mean, in terms of him being a skeptic, he's not looking for, you know, universal arguments in political, yeah, philosophy like you might see from John Rawls or,
right,
Robert Nozick. Rather, he starts from the assumption that, well, at least since the Renaissance, individualism has been ascendant, that we, yeah, think of ourselves as individuals, and this is just the starting place, And that what sort of system we can develop from there. Also, especially looking at the tradition of if you live in a good society, right, like Britain or America, to try to maintain those traditions. A lot of them are not always articulated. To go back to what I was saying, that right, in Britain, there's this idea that some things are just not done.
Yeah,
it's not written down, but we just don't do that.
Yeah.
And so he is trying to conserve tradition, though, I would not say he's against all change.
Yeah.
But he thinks that a lot of social reformers are overly confident in their ability to know the effects of what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah. I also had to ask, I know that you've written about fashion, or in particular men's fashion, and for those of us such as myself who have a very limited fashion sense or understanding of men's attire, is there a way that you would recommend, perhaps even from a philosophical point of view, understanding the significance of dress? I know that you reviewed this book on the suit by Nicholas Anton Giovanni, but are there other ways that you might recommend to kind of gain a greater appreciation for
that? So sure. I mean, first I would note that you will find that a lot of people who are interested in architecture are also interested in clothing.
Yeah.
Because I mean, not well, part of my, one of my theories is that, clothing is something that combines form and function,
yeah,
similar to it, to the way architecture does. And architects are very self-conscious about how they present themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, you will find a lot of classicists wearing tweed and bow ties.
Yes, yes.
And then you'll find all the modernists wearing weird black jackets, yeah, with 20 buttons, and
right,
they wear strange glasses, trying to go back to, reference glasses worn by Le Corbusier.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a joke that you can spot the architects in the room by how strangely they're dressed. And, what are they trying to say? I think maybe one thing, I'm talking about the modernists, one thing they are trying to say is, I am not like you.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not, ordinary Joe.
Right.
I have my complicated elite views and will not be restrained by, ordinary thinking.
Yeah.
So a lot of my interest in menswear comes out of, like, my interest in ideas about the presentation of self and why do people choose the way they choose the dress. I mean, most people don't do it that consciously.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very interesting subject to study. And, you say I wrote about fashion. I prefer to say that I have written about style.
Style, yes.
Because, fashion changes, there are fashion cycles.
Yeah.
Well, style, I mean, in menswear can last for a very long time.
Yes, yes.
I mean, so the first place I'd recommend if people really want to get into this, and this is a good book for, I think, the sorts of people who listen to this podcast, is a book called Sex and Suits by the art historian Anne Hollander, Remembering right.
Yes.
So that is a tremendous book about the history of menswear.
Yeah.
And I think she does compare the suit to like the classical column and and things like this, and talk about how the suit achieved its apogee in the 1930s. And it's such a great, it is a great achievement in that it's something that you can wear in all sorts of social settings.
Yeah.
You can wear it to dinner, you can wear it to work, you can wear it to a wedding. It's incredibly comfortable and free flowing, and that women have nothing like something as versatile and classic as the suit.
Yeah.
So that gives you a sense of some of my interests. And I also think that when a person is dressed a certain way, they just feel better about themselves. I mean, I know this is sort of like the queer eye for the straight guy approach, but there definitely is something true about it where you can feel very confident and comfortable and know who you are. I would never say that there's one right way for all men to dress.
Sure.
But, if I know something about you,
yeah,
then, your personality and all sorts of things like this, then, I have gone clothes shopping with friends of mine, and I don't know, it's kind of a strange interest, but I think it is very important, and there is a whole psychology of clothing. I mean, there's I mean, if you think about it, people treat you differently depending on how you're dressed.
Yeah.
If I go into a fast food restaurant wearing a suit and tie, the person behind the counter is likely to say, you know, how can I help you, sir?
Yeah.
And maybe be more polite. And of course, you know, maybe that's a nice thing. And also, like, maybe makes you a better person. If people are treating you better, then you're going to treat other people better.
Yeah.
There are studies showing that when people dress like in a white coat, like nurses,
right,
that they are more helpful to others about, you know, the clothes do, you know, really can make the man.
Yeah. Well, my last question is, I know that one of the other things I saw that you'd written was a short biography of Joseph Schupa, who maybe was his grandfather.
My great-uncle.
Great-uncle, okay. And I was just curious about, maybe if you could tell us a little bit about your background and whether, had you always had this interest in aesthetics and style and architecture, kind of how you came to your current profession, I guess.
So first you're asking about the Joseph Schubo?
Yes, but how?
Well, I mean, he's my namesake. He was a rabbi in Boston.
Yeah.
And also served as a chaplain in World War II.
Right.
And, you know, I think he was a very inspiring figure.
Yeah.
During the war, he was serving with the American troops who had just crossed the Rhine. And they ended up having a Passover Seder in Goebbels' ancestral castle.
Yeah.
And it made the newspapers. And, you know, it was nice little poetic justice.
Yeah.
And best of all, Goebbels actually found out about it.
Wow.
And so, you know, he was a really interesting figure, an important figure
yeah.
in American Jewish history.
Yeah.
I'll stop there regarding that. But as for my interests, I mean, they really, you know, really bubbled up slowly.
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time, I never even thought twice about my clothes.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, I just started becoming more self-aware and started obsessively reading all the books by Alan Flusser and the experts as to what is, you know, the so-called rules
right.
in menswear. And then I started reading books like Sex and Suits or The Psychology of Clothes. And in architecture, I mean, I do have early memories of really hating what I now realize is a brutalist public library.
Okay. Where was that?
That was in, you know, outside Baltimore.
Okay. Yeah.
And I just hated it. I just hated it. And I am sensitive to my environment.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm in a room with harsh fluorescent lighting, it really bothers me.
Yeah.
And I started just looking around and starting to think, well, why does the world look the way it does?
Yeah.
And I discovered the book From Bauhaus to Our House by Tom Wolfe, which is really just sort of a polemical pamphlet.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just started making me feel more confident that maybe I'm not crazy, that something really has gone wrong in contemporary architecture, and understand the history and the ideas behind it. And I think the more you just hear the architects speaking, the more you'll think that what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, so for instance, you know, I will claim that certain contemporary architects are nihilists, but you will find some of them actually saying they're nihilists. So it's not it's not like, oh, they're reds under the bed.
Right.
It's just listen to what they're actually saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, our guest today has been Justin Schubo. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast. Find out more at athenaeumreview.org.